I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. It's cabin fever week on our show. If you're wondering if the winter will ever end, we offer some optimism with Midday on the Bay on Thursday and some ideas for getting out of the house and back to nature as spring finally comes to Maryland. Today, we have the pleasure of conversation with best-selling author Richard Louv. A few years ago, he provoked a national conversation about the importance of reconnecting kids to nature. He coined the term nature deficit disorder to describe problems that result from spending so little time outdoors. Today, he focuses on reconnecting adults to the natural world in this busy digital age. Richard Louv and The Nature Principle, coming up after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks with you every Monday through Friday, noon to 2 on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPR Ocean City and the Eastern Shore, and streaming live online through WYPR.org, saying hello to a new listener in Australia who emailed us last week, say he found the show online and has been enjoying it. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks for making Midday part of your day. My guest this hour, the journalist Richard Louv, inspired a worldwide conversation and a conversation or two here on Midday about the importance of reconnecting children with nature. That was in 2005 with the publication of his book, Last Child in the Woods. In that book, Richard Louv introduced the term nature deficit disorder to describe the loss of a real and important connection between children and the natural world. Some of its underlying causes, a loss of open space, increasingly busy schedules, and competition from electronic media, just to name a few, and negative effects of the disorder can include certain behavioral and health problems. While the book got people talking about the importance of reconnecting kids to the environment, since it was published, we have continued to experience a decline in time kids are spending outdoors. And adults have experienced a similar disconnect. In fact, Richard Louv has said that it was hearing from adults on the topic that inspired him to write his latest book, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. In 2008, for the first time in history, more than half of the world's population lived in an urban or suburban setting. With that, traditional ways humans experience nature are vanishing, and what's maybe even more alarming is our growing dependence and focus on technology over nature in this, the busy digital age. Richard Louv's latest book, however, is somewhat optimistic. Richard Louv will be speaking tonight about this topic at Notre Dame of Maryland University in an event that's free and open to the public. We'll tell you more about that during this hour of the show. You can find some information about his talk tonight on the Dan Rodericks Facebook page. But for now, here in Studio A, live for the next hour, Richard Louv is our guest. Welcome to Midday, Richard. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks.
You wrote at one point that a woman actually came up to you and grabbed you by the lapels and said, remember, adults have nature deficit disorder too. I guess that's what got you to this book.
Right, and I said, let me go.
You said, let me go. I mean, seriously, I guess you didn't expect the reaction you received from the first book on nature deficit disorder.
No. I'd written, that was my seventh book at that point. And of course, you know, writing books can be an interesting process, and you never expect it to really work, at least not after the first book. But this one this one did, and I think it tapped a nerve. And it you know, this phrase, nature deficit disorder, I actually fought the publisher. I didn't want it on the cover. It was in the book, but I didn't want it on the...
Why? It sounded too clinical?
You know, no, I'm a hoity-toity journalist, and I didn't want to... You know, I don't stoop to bumper stickers, but but which shows you what I know about marketing. But they insisted. I'm very grateful to the Algonquin for insisting. And, you know, it's not a known medical diagnosis. Maybe it should be, but it's not. But it gave a phrase that people could talk about for what they already knew was happening. And I think that was helpful.
Yeah. And the focus was on children, pretty much. And as I just said, it seemed like adults were responding to this, too. This resonated with adults who looked at their lives and said, wait a minute, I don't spend that much time outdoors like I used to. And I live in a way that makes that almost prohibitive.
Well, you're right. And, you know, I kept thinking when I was writing the second book, The Nature Principle, which was more about adults, I kept thinking, you know, I'm talking a lot about health, about the health benefits of being outdoors, the psychological benefits, the benefits to physical health. But the more I thought about it, as well as cognitive functioning, that there's something even larger here that people are hungry for. And it has to do with the full use of the senses. The people who study, scientists who study the human senses, no longer talk about five senses. They talk about conservatively 10 senses and as many as 30. And they all have names and they're very interesting. And we're constructing an environment in which most of us, particularly kids, but adults too, spend most of our time in front of screens. And most of our hours, or many of them at least, we spend blocking out most of those senses, including the ones we don't even know we have. And that, to me, is the very definition of being less alive. You know, what parent wants their kid to be less alive? Who among us wants to? Some people want to be less alive, but I don't. And I think that's kind of the bottom line of this issue.
I worry with children that they're growing up immersed in this environment, right? This digital, we'll call it the digital environment. They don't know what that other one's like. So the balance is way off there. And time goes by, and before you know it, this is the new normal. The new normal is in front of a screen.
Yeah, and I'm not anti-tech. I want to make that clear. In The Nature Principle, the second book, I have this line that I repeat often, which is, the more high-tech our lives become, the more nature we need. We need that balance. It's not a question whether, you know, I'm not a Luddite. I love my iPad and so forth. But all of us have this sense that we need to get away from these things sometimes. And where are we going to go? What are we going to do when we get away? What's the best balance? And some of the science on this says that we need to pay a different kind of attention in order to give that part of our brain a rest that gets burned out through what's called directed attention, which mainly is what we use when we're in front of computers and when we're doing the kind of work more and more of us do. And the different kind of attention is sometimes called fascination. That's a kind of a technical term for that kind of. It's when we're paying so much attention we don't know we're paying attention. And it turns out the best place to get that is in the natural world. So if we give ourselves a break, my wife and I go on techno fasts. We leave for a few days, and I think the first time we did that, we went up to a mountain cabin near where we live in San Diego for like 4 or 5 days, and we left all the electronics behind, well, except my Kindle. That doesn't count because I can't get into the internet, but we just read, and we typed, and we spent time outdoors. As we were leaving town, I actually felt like I was going through withdrawal. All these anxiety, what if an email comes in with a problem I can't solve immediately, and what am I going to do? The farther we got out of town, the more of that weight lifted. By the time we got into that cabin, for a day or so, my sleep patterns returned to normal. I felt like a normal human being again. Mm. And I think when we think about the climate our kids are living in, what do they do? How do we give them a break from that? We have to start, I think, first by giving ourselves a break.
The people who responded to the first book and the discussion of nature deficit disorder, did they describe this yearning that they have, a recognition that something's missing, a yearning that they have but hard to get, almost like, you want to go on a diet, for instance, and you keep failing. You want to get back to nature, take a hike in the woods somewhere, even go camping, and you keep failing because life is busy and you're bogged down in a busy life. Did you hear that from people?
Sure. And it's not easy. I mean, it seems easy. It seems like it would be easy. But one thing that has occurred, as you said in the intro, is of 2008, more people in the whole world live in cities than in the countryside. And that's the first time in human history. So we are moving into cities as a species. So one of the issues is to redefine nature. It's not just wilderness. It can be your backyard. It can be a window box. It can be a green roof that is planted so that it begins to help bring back butterfly migration routes. That fact that as of 2008, more of us live in cities, that means one of two things. Either the human race is going to rapidly lose whatever connection it has to the natural world, or it means the beginning of a new kind of city. And that's where it, to me, it gets particularly interesting. Tonight, you know, when I talk to the students and faculty and others, the public at the Notre Dame speech, I want to focus largely on the hope issue here, on the fact that we have great opportunities now to rethink the way we live, to rethink our lives. I no longer talk, I use the word sustainability. It's kind of an awkward word now. It's lost a lot of its meaning, but I use it less and less. Increasingly, what I like to talk about is a nature-rich city, a nature-rich home, nature-rich yard, nature-rich school, nature-rich workplace. When you begin to look at the studies of biophilic design, for instance, using nature in the design of a workplace, outside, inside, keep it there, the biophilic designers who are studying this find that the people in those workplaces are more productive, sick time goes down, turnover gets better. In other words, you're no longer just saving energy, you're producing human energy through nature. What if we looked at our cities like that? Now, the northeastern cities have this advantage because you had Frederick Law Olmsted. You had a lot of parks.
Here in Baltimore, too.
But what if we really began to think about, our buildings, our neighborhoods, our homes, and native species instead of Kentucky bluegrass, those kinds of things that really begin to increase the biodiversity of where we live, learn, work, and play. The urban parks that have the highest biodiversity turn out to be the ones that have the best impact on human psychological health and well-being, partly because we realize we're not alone.
So there's a lot we can do with these environments that have already been created for us over time in urban centers and cities and suburban areas.
Right.
Yeah. Because one of the reactions I have to what you're saying is population growth working against all of these ideas. You know, there are so many of us now. And let's say of all those many people that keep growing here with the population, there is this yearning to be in the outdoors, to reconnect with nature. There's only so much room for those who do crave that, right? But what you're talking about is something you can do down the street from, or even in your own backyard.
Right. I think this study was done in part in Baltimore, but there was a study of urban neighborhoods that found that that the child obesity rate goes down. The greener the neighborhood, the lower the bio, the child obesity rate, the BMI is. And what they were looking at is urban, very urban neighborhoods. And what they found was distinct from the density of human beings in that neighborhood. In other words, you can have more people in a neighborhood and more quote-unquote natural habitat through design.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can have an effect on human health.
We're going to take a break here. Richard Louv is our guest. His latest book is The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorders. So some optimism here, some ideas that we'll be sharing with Richard in this hour of the show. I must say, this is Cabin Fever Week on Midday, because later in the week we're going to be talking about things you can actually do in Maryland with the coming spring. And yes, spring is coming. I know it doesn't seem that way, but I think it's due to arrive even this week sometime. And also on Friday, we'll be devoting part of Friday's show to program Open Space in Maryland to let you know what's going on with efforts to keep open space in our state and preserve more of our natural environment. So that's our theme here. We're starting off with Richard Louv, our guest in this hour of the show. You're welcome to call with a comment or question about nature deficit disorder and what we can do about it in this busy digital age that we live in. 410-662-8780 is our local phone number, toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. Our midday email address, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back with Richard Louv. Dan Roderick's here on Midday. Richard Louv's latest book, The Nature Principle, Human Restoration and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. And we've had several discussions about nature deficit disorder. We talked about, remember the first time it came up, your book came up, was during a discussion about play, about playtime and how children lack Children lack playtime, real playtime, imaginative playtime, not playtime in a Game Boy or in a, you know, some electronic game. And there was a connection between that and the nature deficit. It's children not spending enough time outdoors. And I wonder, are we making, it doesn't sound like we are, but are we making any progress with kids? Is there any measure of that in measuring the connection between children and the outdoors? Anything that's come of your book and really sort of a movement it launched?
Well, there has. And first, the play issue is very important. That's the kind of the parallel issue to time spent in nature, which is the disappearance of independent make-believe play. That's connected directly, particularly in young children, with the development of what's called executive functioning, the ability to be your own executive, your own boss.
Mm-hmm.
That has something to do, by the way, with whether we're going to have entrepreneurs in the future. It turns out that a study was done, repeating a study that was done in the 1940s, that looked at executive function in children. And they found that a 7-year-old today has the executive function of a 5-year-old in the 1940s. In other words, we sliced away 2 years of child development and executive function. You have to ask what has changed about childhood that we're actually regressing in terms of the ability to control yourself and be your own boss. That's happening, that disappearance of independent play, because we're always on top of our kids. We're always telling them what to do. We're always telling them how to do it. And if we're not, the computer or the television or the video game is doing that. There's a theory in play, child play, called the loose parts theory, that the more loose parts there are in an environment, the more creative the play is. Now, video games can be creative. There's lots of loose parts in terms of the programming, but those are limited to the imagination of somebody that's sitting in a room, probably without windows, in Silicon Valley, who's had way too much pizza.
Yeah, right.
You know, who,
right.
And you know, that's not like a tree.
Yeah,
you know, that's
yeah.
not
sticks
like beans
and stones and string. Right.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. There isn't a computer in the world that will stimulate the senses like being, you know, out in the woods and listening to the wind and the trees. So those are two very important issues that are connected and are not getting much attention, certainly in our schools. In our schools, there are great teachers out there, but the direction of education today is in exactly the opposite direction.
Do you see any efforts? Can you speak of one where it's in the opposite direction, in your direction, toward the outdoors with teaching?
Yeah, there is a counter trend. Most of the movement is toward electronics solving everything, right? There is a counter trend, though. There are more and more nature preschools. Sometimes they're called forest schools. You know, in Europe, they go to extremes. They have schools with no buildings sometimes, but I doubt that's going to happen here. But what's happening here is that you have more and more early grades, particularly in the independent schools, that are really getting their kids outside to learn. And they're finding that this environment of learning is very stimulating. Kids who play in a natural play space, you know, with rolling areas and grass and trees, etc. Those kids, when they're compared to kids who are playing on a typical flat playground, are far more likely to invent their own games. They're more likely to include kids that are not like themselves in their own play than they are in a flat playground or turf play area. So we can create, I think, learning environments in our schools and in our homes that are far more productive of kids who can be their own boss, et cetera.
When it comes to adults, I want to ask you about this, Richard Louv. People think of themselves as either an environmentalist or not, a nature person or not. I mean, it's sort of a way of defining someone, right? My sister Carol, oh, she's a real nature person. Meaning, what does that mean? It means she goes on hikes. She's actually camped out a couple of times in her life compared to other members of the family who do not consider themselves nature people. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about. I guess this maybe has always been the case. Someone who does gardening in the backyard may not necessarily consider themselves a nature person or an environmentalist in those classic terms, the way we use those terms. So it seems to me what you're getting at here is there is a way for everybody to sort of connect and have a nature-rich life, but you don't have to look at it as, you know, either a nature person who goes to Glacier National Park or not, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
You're bringing it down to the ground level here.
Yeah, and there's one thing I didn't know. Well, there's a lot of things I didn't know when I was writing the first book, Last Child in the Woods. One of them was how universal this topic is. It doesn't seem to matter what somebody's politics or religion is. They all want to tell me about the treehouse they had when they were kids, if they're old enough to have had that.
Right.
And they really want to tell me about it. And I never get tired of listening to these stories from adults about their special place in nature. Nobody wants to be in the last generation where that's considered normal and expected. And so conservatives, liberals, I mean, there's something about this issue that brings people together. And you asked earlier about, you know, the good news. The good news is that there is a movement that has emerged. There are now, I believe, 120 regional and state and city campaigns all over North America to get kids outdoors. And some of these are quite large. There are family nature clubs that are emerging all over the country. There's over 200 of these now. And this started a couple of years ago. This idea has existed for a long time, but particularly in the last couple of years. These are multiple families that decide to band together to show up at the park on Saturday and go for a hike, something like that, do gardening, whatever. It deals with this issue of fear, which is one of the main reasons people don't go outside very much and let their kids go outside is they fear stranger danger. Well, there's perceived safety in numbers when these families get together. The Family Nature Club in San Diego, where I'm from, now has over 1,000 families. Families, not just individuals, but families. These are spreading all over the country. Many of them have hundreds of families. They don't all go out at once together as hundreds of families, but they have other families they can turn to and do this. It means they're more likely to do it. You don't have to wait for a foundation grant. You don't have to wait for an organizational, you know, blessing. You just do it. And you can download, by the way, a free toolkit on how to create your own Family Nature Club from the Children and Nature Network, which is childrenandnature.org. Which is the nonprofit that grew out of Last Child in the Woods.
Do you find that those are the families are families of young children? I'm curious what happens with adolescents and teens, whether they maintain their interest, even if it's garnered, if it's fostered when they're, you know, 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah, it does. It does focus on younger families. And you're right. There is a drop off when, I mean, teenagers get interested in a different kind of biology later.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they come back. I mean, if they ever go. I mean, a lot of teenagers are getting this. They understand this. And, you know, when I talk to kids, I talk to particularly middle school kids tend to be a very good group for this. I talk to them about their senses, their super senses. They have these superpowers they don't even know they have. I mean, you can track through the woods just with your nose. We didn't know this before until there was a study done.
We have two nostrils for a reason.
That's right. It's like it's like stereophonic sound.
Right.
And I actually found that out after I came back from a trip to Kodiak, Alaska with my younger son, who likes to fish, and I like to fish, and we went up there. The guide that was taking us up this river, the stream, taught us how to smell for bears. You already know you make a lot of noise. You let them know you don't. These are Alaskan brown bears, like ones that like to have you over for lunch. So you have to make a lot of noise. But he said, "I'm going to teach you something. Come on over here." And he taught us how to this smell. And once you've smelled this smell, you never forget. It's a combination of bear musk and rotten salmon. They like to roll in the salmon.
Mm-hmm.
That very useful skill to have when you're surrounded by Alaskan brown bears, and you are up there. My son's comment was, "This sure beats high school." And then we came back, and then I found out about this study that said they'd use, of course, college students as guinea pigs, and they blindfolded them, covered their ears. They could literally track through the woods a trail of scent. And the researchers found that people do this thing instinctively that all animals that make their living with their noses do. They zigzagged. Just instinctively, they zigzag. So part of this is about this fuller organism that we are, that we tend to forget. We have all of these senses that we tend not to use. We don't even know we have. I mean, people have some of the skills of bats for echolocation. People who have lost their sight, some of them, are learning to use this. And this has to do with this issue of being fully alive.
There's an extraordinary moment that you can have in nature if you're there at the right time, usually maybe in the spring. I guess it could be in the summer, too. Hiking in some place where you haven't been before, and there's some extraordinary aroma, usually perfumey, you know, a flower in bloom, a special plant or something. You may not be able to identify it. It's just that, wow, I mean, it hits you, and it's like, wow, I don't remember anything like that, or it's been a long time since that happened to me. And it's not something you can get in your kitchen at home, even. It is an extraordinary experience. It occurs to me, Richard Louvre, that we think that the digital age has been long in coming, right? That it seems like it's been around for a long time. It's only a nanosecond in time when all this has happened. Think of all that's happened to us in just 10 years. What kind of, you know, innovations have occurred? Facebook, Facebook had its 10th anniversary, I think, last month or something. So all this has happened kind of quickly, and we've adapted to it and grabbed it, and we want more and more, they keep telling us, right? Because Apple and other companies are always looking for the next big thing in technology. So it's come on real quickly, and I think the reason your theme was so popular with people a few years ago is because, wait a minute, he's right. What's happened to us? It's not just television watching. It's another thing that's pulled us indoors or kept us indoors. And we're losing that connection. Some people may not even know that it's happening, right? Because we've got so sucked into this new world, this digital world that we're in, we might not even know what we're missing.
Well, it's, you know, the invention of the internet has been ranked with the invention of the wheel. I mean, it's one of the great inventions of all of our history as a species. And I think it's easy to underestimate its impact. One of the things that I'm increasingly concerned about is education. There is a powerful, powerful lobby, the people essentially controlling the future debate about the future of the school in our society have something to sell. And it's computers, and it's screens and tablets and educational software. And believe me, some of that does great things. I mean, I love the internet. It makes my job a lot easier. I understand the importance of that. But when you've got an economic force that big, basically in control of the debate about the future of education, without a counterforce to that, saying, now, wait a minute, don't we need some balance? You may have a problem. The Common Core standards are coming, and I'm kind of an agnostic about those. It's probably a good idea. I'm not an agnostic on how they may well be executed. There's a debate going on that the public really is not involved with about the use of technology in our schools. And the idea basically is the classroom will become immersed in electronics, more and more video games used as teaching tools in the classroom. The technology, the good news is that testing as we know it will fade away. The not so good news, at least to me, is that we won't need it because the machines will be watching these kids all the time. Some of the same technologies used to track produce in supermarkets, inventory, is being projected into our classrooms in the future. Professors right now can assign books, e-books, and they can check exactly where you're at in the book as a student. I don't know about you, but I find that a little creepy. Some of us don't have to finish the whole book, particularly my books, by the way.
Well, there's an acceptance of the premise that those are the tools of the future. In order for us to compete in the global economy, in order for the next generation coming along to compete, to excel, to prosper, they need to be adept at all those tools.
Right.
There's an acceptance of that idea. And I think an emphasis on it, like you're describing, without what imbalance? So what's missing in that?
Well, one thing is that, you know, a tool today that seems all important will be obsolete in about 3 years. And so we're training kids for the use of technologies that are going to quickly be, you know, gone and replaced by so-called better technology. So, you know, it's kind of what about the things that last? What about the things that go beyond that? I've been talking recently about what I call the hybrid mind. as a different approach to education. The hybrid mind is best explained by telling a story about a guy that I met who teaches people how to become the pilots of cruise ships. We need a few good pilots of cruise ships. And he said that he gets two kinds of students. One kind grew up in front of video games, et cetera. He said, they have a talent I need. They know how to use the electronics, got a lot of electronics on the ships. The second kind of student that I get, he said, grew up more outside. He said, those kind of students also have a skill I need. They can actually tell where the ship is. And he wasn't being facetious. He was being literal. He said they have a set of senses that's been developed so that they literally know more about where they are in a spatial sense. He said the ideal student to him would be a student who has both sets of abilities, both the virtual set,
right,
electronics, and the set that is more accustomed to dealing with the real world, with physical world. That, to me, is the hybrid mind. What if we had that as one of our objectives? That balance would be an objective education.
So you'd have a GPS in one hand and know how to use it, but also instincts that are developed that tell you exactly where you are and how to get home, maybe.
Right. And, I think, you know, the schools would be okay if for every dollar we spend on the virtual, we spend another dollar on the real. If we do that, the kids will be okay. If we don't, maybe not.
Richard Louv is our guest in this hour of midday. His latest book is The Nature Principle, Human Restoration, and the End of Nature Deficit Disorder. Maybe a little bit more on human restoration when we get back after this break. Richard Louv, of course, the author of the international bestseller Last Child in the Woods, about nature deficit disorder. Richard is tonight speaking at Notre Dame of Maryland University, right here in Baltimore, the School of Education's 2014 speaker series, The New Nature Movement, is at 7 p.m. tonight. More about that after this break. You're welcome to call and join our conversation, 410-662-8780, the midday email address, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. With Richard Louv. His book is The Nature Principle. The Nature Principle, which holds that in an age of environmental, economic, and social transformation, the future will belong to the nature smart, those individuals, businesses, and political leaders who develop a deeper understanding of nature and balance the virtual with the real. I guess that's what you were talking about just before the break, the hybrid mind.
Right.
Yeah. Why is it so important to develop that? Would you say going forward here? Some people may listen to that and say, "Yeah, okay, maybe." I'm not sure I quite understand is he talking about appreciating nature so that we don't all die from what's coming with global warming and climate change? You're talking about something different. You're talking about a sort of more organic way of living and thinking.
Yeah, and it's not just going to the organic, you know, the organic food store.
Yeah, that's not what I mean. Yeah.
It's really a question of design, what kind of cities we want to live in, what kind of yards we want to have, what kind of schools. You ask for an example of things that people could do or that they are doing. One of the ideas that I really like is the idea of creating a homegrown national park. And that's the idea of a guy who wrote a really great book called Bringing Nature Home. And the basic idea is to redo your yard in native species. This theory holds that if we really want to do something about biodiversity, the biodiversity crash, we'll spend less money on Brazil and more money on our yards and convert about 40% of our yards to native species. My wife and I did this recently, and the yard is great. It's beautiful. This can be done in a beautiful way. It uses less water. All kinds of species are returning, native butterflies we've never seen. It's really improved, you know, it improves your psychological well-being, by the way, to have this kind of environment. But what if it wasn't just our yard? What if it's the next yard, and skip a couple of yards? Then pretty soon you're creating wildlife corridors on private land. And what if that went from city to city? What if we just announced it to be so? Let's create a homegrown national park. Don't need an act from Congress. Think of the power that kids would feel and families would feel if they were part of something that large. lately, I just got back from Australia, and I was talking about how about a worldwide homegrown park? What if we thought about this in terms of the whole world, of truly greening our lives, our cities?
We've had a controversy in Maryland over a stormwater fee that the legislature authorized 10 jurisdictions, the city and the nine largest counties, to implement. And money that would go toward efforts to arrest stormwater that, it's been ridiculed as a rain tax. But, the idea is there to arrest stormwater flow into the Chesapeake Bay. And some of the ideas that have come out of this, call for people to do what you're describing in their own backyards to the extent that they can, or on their roofs or wherever, to make small efforts in order to arrest stormwater from running off, all of this running off with pesticides or oil or gasoline, whatever comes out of our backyards and our driveways and our streets into the bay. And there's been this uproar about the fee and who pays it and how much it is. But the piece that's missing for a lot of people who argue about it being a tax is the opportunity it presents for individuals to do exactly what you're talking about in their own backyards and in their neighbors' yards or wherever, at their businesses as well.
That's right. Businesses, schools. It's not a panacea. It's not the only way to do it. Nature is not a panacea. It doesn't work for everybody. I understand that. But when you begin to imagine a future that is nature-rich, it's a very different kind of future than what we... This touches something I've been thinking about a lot recently, which I'm convinced that most Americans, if you ask them to describe how the far future will look, what images pop into their mind, I think most Americans, the images that pop up first are ones that look a lot like Blade Runner, Mad Max, at best The Hunger Games, because at least there's a few trees in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a post-apocalyptic future. The number one young adult fiction genre today is called dystopic fiction, which is about a post-apocalyptic world in which not even vampires are having a good time. If I'm right, and I have nothing against dystopic fiction. I mean, 1984 was a good warning, but it's the absence of another set of images of a great future that is troublesome. I'm not talking about a sustainable. William McDonough, the great green guru, likes to ask this question: do you really want a sustainable marriage? Don't you want something better than that? Now, sometimes sustainable is good, but I think that if we don't aim a lot higher than energy efficiency and sustainability, which is how most people define that, it's energy efficiency, we're not even going to get close to that. And what about a different set of images about what the future could look like? I spent some time, more and more time with students these days, and a college student, young woman, very hip young woman, I know that because she had tattoos, she said, I'm 20 years old, and all my life I've been told it's too late. And I thought about it, and she's right.
Yeah.
That's about the window that media, in fact,
yeah,
well-meaning environmentalism.
But that's a scary thing. I spoke to a young man about an automobile he was thinking of buying, and we were talking about the mileage. And I said, you want maximum efficiency, don't you? He said, well, it's not going to matter.
Yeah.
Please don't give up. All right, Richard, we'll take some phone calls from our listeners here on Midday. We'll go to Heidi in Timonium and start with you. Thanks for calling Midday, Heidi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go right ahead, please.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Lou, for doing all this great work that you're doing. I'm a psychotherapist, and I always ask my clients when they walk in how they experience God. And a lot of them speak about nature, how they feel connected to God more in nature than in any other place. I'm also doing a dissertation on that, looking at what the role of spirituality is when people engage in nature and their psychological well-being. And so I just wanted to ask you, what do you think is the role of spirituality in motivating people to engage in nature or even, take care of nature?
Oh, that's a great question. There was a study, a big study done by MIT in the 1990s of language and how people talked about nature. And everybody, including atheists, used religious terms or spiritual terms. It seems to be something that's universal. I was surprised, you know, when I wrote Last Child in the Woods, there's a chapter near the end of it called The Spiritual Necessity for Nature, of Nature for Children. And, you know, I put it at the end because that topic often makes people nervous. I was surprised at the response from religious groups. I thought I would get some grief from some religious groups because they might think I was trying to get their kids to worship nature. I've gotten none of that from all kinds of religious groups. In fact, one of the first champions of it was the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Very conservative guy. I think over time I came to realize that smart religious or spiritual people all kind of intuitively know that all spiritual life begins with a sense of wonder. What's one of the first windows into wonder that we have when we're kids? You know, maybe you're like me and you have a memory of crawling out through the grass when you're three or three and a half and to where the grass ends and the rocks and the weeds and the woods begin, and you turn over a rock and you find out for the first time that you're not alone in the universe. And that sense of awe and wonder you first felt when you heard wind in the trees and knew that you were not alone, one way or another, not alone. How can we shut that window? And I think that that's one of the reasons why this is not an unpopular issue among religious people.
The stormwater fee I mentioned before. I've read recently stories about churches in Maryland getting right involved in that to do something about their giant parking lots, and pastors have included discussions about the environment with their liturgy, discussions of their gospel in regard to this. So it's a good thing. Yeah. A couple of emails for you. One is from Bridget, making an observation. She went to visit the Rosedale Library a few months back for their toddler story hour. Apparently, the librarians are being encouraged to include iPads in their children's story hour. As a result, during the story hour I attended with my four-year-old, the librarian passed around leaves she had collected from outside, then proceeded to use her iPad to show the kids more pictures of leaves. Since when did an iPad photo of a leaf triumph the real thing? Well, at least she had both there, right? At least she had the real thing.
Yeah, it's a good story. And it kind of depends on how they were using the iPad, too. But, you know, that might be an example of the hybrid mind. It's kind of hard without being there how much emphasis was placed on the leaf, and at least they had some leaves in there.
That's what I know.
And by the way, libraries are getting involved with this too. There's some, I call them naturebraries. They're starting to create outdoor reading areas and really getting involved in this movement. Hmm.
Shay in Baltimore, you're on next with Richard Louvre.
Hi, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit nervous. I wish that I could just sit down and join in this great conversation for your whole hour, but I just have two comments. One is, I have a 12-year-old daughter, and she's in school, and she's doing really well, but my comments are, one is a parent's lack of control over our children's education in pursuit of organic learning, as in kids, you know, they want to know things. I asked my daughter about her science book, and I said, "Oh, this looks interesting. What is this about?" And she said, "Mommy, I don't know. They're not testing for that." And, you know, so I'm like, you know, I have so many friends that my daughter goes to Roland Park Elementary Public, and I have so many friends that feel at a loss of being able to have any say in their children's education as far as developing and encouraging their natural curiosity.
That's right. Let's hear from Richard on that, Shay. Thank you.
Well, there is a counter movement, both among teachers and among parents. I mean, homeschooling has caught on, not only among religious people, but among others. There's more and more of that. There are teachers that are insisting on resisting the idea that only that which can be counts counts. Only that which can be counted counts. There is, by the way, on Einstein's door, there was a sign that said, not everything that can be counts. Not everything that can be counted counts. There are teachers that still take their kids outdoors, insist on doing it. We call them natural teachers. We've created a natural teachers network so they can get together online and trade notes and know that they're not alone. Oftentimes, it's not the environmental education teacher necessarily. It's the English teacher or the art teacher insisted in taking kids outside under the trees and writing and drawing.
Why does this have to always fall to the teachers, however? I mean, what about parents?
And likewise, why does it always have to fall to the parents? There's a lot of people who like to blame parents for everything, and I don't.
I don't blame them. I'm just saying when it comes to this, if you acknowledge, okay, what's going on in your school, maybe you can't influence that. They are teaching to the test. Let's accept that as the reality today.
I think both parents and teachers need something larger around them. They need a bigger boat. They need a bigger constituency to help them. And that's one of the reasons why I think this movement to reconnect kids to nature is so important. It helps build that constituency.
Rebecca, in Baltimore, you're on with Richard Louvre. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Go right ahead, please.
Hi. I'm a teacher. I'm a career teacher, actually, in a great school that has embraced technology to the nth degree. But I got to say, I have to echo and affirm what your guest has talked about in terms of the diminishing skills and executive functioning and the soaring attention issues that I'm seeing with my very, very intelligent students. But they are incredibly and increasingly relying on much more technology, and they're really disconnected from the world. I'd also like to just say that the parents out there wondering, my own son is at the Waldorf School of Baltimore, where, if you know anything about Waldorf education, is a global movement that really embraces being in nature and the human being as very connected into the natural world as a core component of education. And from my perspective, he's been there now from K through through fifth grade, and I'm seeing a student who can read and write, but also be able to really be a pretty alive person in every sense of the word. And I see that in his classmates as well. So.
All right, thank you, Rebecca. We're short of time. Richard?
Well, Waldorf has been on this scene for a long time and is doing good things. There are other independent schools that do this. There are public schools that have moved in this direction, charter schools, charter high schools that are nature-centric. I think that there are alternatives out there. One of the places you can go to find out about what kind of schools are emerging is the Children in Nature Network. Again, that's childreninnature.org. There's lots of good, hopeful news there. There's ways that you can connect to other people. There's ways that you can learn how to change your own school, how to connect with other parents, how to be part of this larger movement.
Sally writes in to say, although I strongly support Richard's thoughts about getting kids and adults outside, I also find that some kinds of tech connections like Cornell's Backyard Feeder Project help to interest kids in observing nature and posting results online. So Sally wanted to note that Cornell University.
Yeah, absolutely. And I promote that, by the way. I think Cornell's doing great.
The Backyard Feeder Project.
Right. And the Bird Count Project, where kids are out there and others are helping track migration routes, et cetera.
And here's a comment from Jake in Baltimore. He says, the idea of a techno-fast sounds perfectly, or techno-fast, I'm sorry, that's the way you described earlier, sounds perfectly idyllic. Maybe you could give it up for Lent, right? Unfortunately, I can feel my bank account dwindling with every passing day in which I'm not using my iPhone or computer. I would like to unplug the cord in some 50 years when I retire. That's what Jake says. Well, we're not talking about completely unplugging all the time either.
No, and
what's wrong with a little fast, right?
I would suggest that fast will make you more productive, will improve your bank account in the long run if you do it often enough.
That's how you felt after yours.
That's right. Yeah. It actually increases productivity.
Richard Louvre is going to be at Notre Dame of Maryland University tonight at 7 p.m. You can find information about it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. He's at Leclerc Auditorium. Thank you, Richard.
Well, thank you.